Homage to Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So there are all kinds of ways of pointing to the Buddha mind, that which is beyond the opposites in a sense. But one of the ways of pointing to that are these Buddhist sutras or texts. So this is just one way. So don't worry if you don't understand any of it. There are other ways of realizing the truth, if you like. But someone's put this into some form of words to point to what's beyond. And sutras are a bit like maps, you know, like Google Maps. If you want to, you can see here on Google Maps. You can see the building, you can see the pond. And in a way you can sort of have an overview of where it is and almost like zero in on it. But to understand really, you have to visit here. You actually have to experience it directly. Coming here, you can't. So the maps are just something which point to what is a direct experience. So this is one of those maps, and it's part of a larger group of scriptures called the Prajnaparamita scriptures, which I think were about in the second century or a bit before. They're quite old, but they're later. They're after the Buddha's passed away. And, 500, 600, 700 years afterwards, Buddhism is getting restated. And this scripture has, almost like anything, has a history. And these days there are people who have looked in detail as to where this has come from and analysed the text. And it seems that it's in at least three different sections. There's the section about Avalokiteshvara, there's the middle section, which is all about the emptiness of the various analyses, Buddhist analysis doctrines, and then there's the mantra section. But if you just explain that the Prajnaparamita Sutra, its title is the Mahaprajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. And that's been translated as the heart piece of the great sutra of the perfection of wisdom that leads to the other shore, to go beyond or to go beyond limits. Because the word prajna has been two parts to it. Pra means before, and the jnā bit means knowing, so it's before knowledge. It's something which is something that's underlying, if you see what I mean. The word, that kind of knowing, always in Buddhism implies a kind of separation, because in order to know something, it has to be you and something else, and this is pointing to that which is beyond that. So what I was going to do first was read, this is a different translation of it. Get this out. I'm not sure if this is where this has come from, but it's I have to take my specs off because I can't see anymore. But it's taken this, the text which we have, and it's a more expanded version of it, because we have almost like a concise version. So it starts off with, thus have I heard. A lot of Buddhist texts, scriptures, always start off with, thus have I heard. It's because it's a way to legitimize a text by saying, relating it to the time when Ananda recited all of the Buddha's teachings after the Buddha had passed away. And Ananda had a kind of photographic memory. It's almost like press play and Ananda recites it all. So, and he always started off by saying, "Thus have I heard." So it's a reference to that, and it's the way they just make sutras start with that. It's, as I say, it's a way to make them part of the Buddhist canon of scriptures. So, "Thus have I heard. The Lord and a great assembly of monks were meditating on Vulture's Peak in Rajagraha. The Arya Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, treading the path of perfection of wisdom, which is profound and unfathomable, beheld only the five aggregates, which in themselves were empty of an independent self-existence. Inwardly prompted by the Lord Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra asked the Bodhisattva, 'How should we understand the Prajnaparamita?' Arya Avalokiteshvara replied, 'O Shariputra, form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Form is none different or none separate from emptiness, and emptiness is none different from form. That which is form is emptiness, and that which is emptiness is form. Even so are feelings, perception, psychological impressions or tendencies, and consciousness. Hear, O Shariputra, all Dharma, phenomena or elements are characterized by emptiness. They are not given rise to, nor are they restrained. They are neither impure nor immaculate, neither inadequate nor complete. Thus, O Shariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no mental impressions or tendencies, no consciousness, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, or psychological objects, that means thoughts and so on, nothing known as the element of sight and so on up to the element of the mind. There is no ignorance and hence no cessation of ignorance and so on. There is neither birth and death nor their cessation, no sorrow, its arising nor its cessation, nor a path to such cessation. There is no wisdom, attainment or non-attainment. Thus, because there is no attainment, the Bodhisattva dwells solely in perfect wisdom, without the least veil of mental activity. Because of the absence of this veil, nothing makes him fear. He has transcended whatever is capable of disturbing him, and he attains nirvana, in which he remains firmly established. All the Buddhas in the three periods of time are established in the perfection of wisdom, and are therefore fully awake to the right and perfect enlightenment. Therefore one should know that the Prajnaparamita Mahamantra, which is supreme knowledge, supreme mantra, and which remedies all sufferings and sorrow, in truth for its true, here is the mantra declared in Prajnaparamita. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone totally beyond, the awakening Svaha." So that's the scripture we have. This is a kind of assembly out, but almost like it's in shorthand. That's why Avalokiteshvara, when one with deepest wisdom of the heart, you know, Avalokiteshvara explains to Shariputra the rest of it. So you sort of have a, do you see what I mean? It's just shortened and doesn't explain the whole assembly and the fact that the Buddha's in meditation and is prompted by the Buddha to ask Avalokiteshvara about great wisdom. And there's no accident that that's the way it is, because Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva Compassion, explains this whole emptiness thing to Shariputra. Shariputra in traditional Buddhism is the absolute expert on Abhidharma, so he's been put right. This scripture has spin, so it's a way of, it's almost like showing, here's the things which you, your analysis shows you, and now it is put into this emptiness treatment. So in some ways it's helpful to have some idea of the elements of what are explained in here. So it talks about the five skandhas, skandhas five, and it and then there's the whole eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no form, no taste. There's a way of analysing things into form, sensation, thought, activity, consciousness. Then you've got the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. These things, and then what they do, they taste, their sound, the colour, the touch, the objects, then their kind of mental qualities, vision, consciousness, etc. So there's a kind of a the skandhas, and then there's a kind of analysis of how those operate. And then there's the, until we come to where old age and death have ceased, and so all extinction of old and age and death. That's a shorthand for the cycle of interdependent origination. I don't know if you're aware of that. Have you seen that? Do you know that? That's a kind of, you see those Tibetan pictures of a fearsome-looking character holding what is a giant mirror, and round the edges are these 12 links which explain how this cause leads to that effect, leads that cause, leads to that effect. So this is almost like a shorthand for, it starts with ignorance and it ends up with old age, disease and death, but there's another 11 or 10 things in between. So it's that's another standard kind of teaching. And then it's, for here there's no suffering, no accumulation. This bit here is a reference to the Four Noble Truths. So it's, and then there's another two on the end, no knowledge, no attainment. In the Eightfold Path, there are actually another two. There's actually a Tenfold Path. Knowledge and attainment are an extra two parts to that. So it's including that. And then, so that's this kind of standard, very background doctrines and analysis that happens in Buddhism. And when one sees, it's almost like one lets go of that, then it explains how the obstacles dissolve and you're no longer afraid. I'll perhaps go back a bit because some of that may not make much sense. One of the things that happened after, well, during the Buddha's time, actually, and one of the key things about Buddhism is the Buddha was concentrating on about suffering and that sense of unsatisfactoriness and how it's created. And his explanation is that, you know, this is what happens as a result of us holding on to something which is inherently impermanent. There is a whole causation cycle which makes us experience that. You know, you see it, you want it, you need it, you must have it, you get something else, it's not quite right, you want something, that sort of cycle. That person makes me angry, it affects the way my body is, it affects how I sense them, come into contact with them again. Another situation happens, arises, and it leaves us wanting, you know, irritated with that person again. We're locked into these loops. These are the interdependent origination loops that give the rise to the sense of unease and unsatisfactoriness. And the answer to dealing with those kind of strong cycles was the Eightfold Path, how you practice speech. These days it's send. You press a button which says send and it imprints something on the service of the internet, which is very hard to take back. There's people who seem to press send with great abandon these days, and it affects people and creates suffering. Or if it's in the right way, it can create a sense of peace and ease. But there's something about how you speak has been an important part of the practice of speak, and how you act, the precepts, actions which create that sense of unease, or then the wider actions or your interaction with the community, which certain things were seen as creating a lot more problems than others, like trafficking people or dealing in poisons or weapons. But there's so that how you interact with the wider community can make an impression. And then there are the internal practices of effort and mindful awareness and meditation, which are almost like help you deal with how you your mind and how you think and how you speak and act. And that then changes your understanding and your general thoughts, your understanding that you aren't quite so separate than you might think, and that the that everything is interdependent or interconnected. And then as a result of that, your thoughts or your views will tend to compassion, kindness, and letting things go, which then works on how you speak, act, and interact. So that kind of, it's like a washing machine cycle. It goes at the strong cycles that create the sense of unease or unsatisfactoriness, leading to the almost like the empty circle, the peace, the bright stillness of nirvana, which is, so there was the Buddha said there was a disease, you know, that sense of unsatisfactoriness, it has a cause, it's possible to cure it, which is this experience of nirvana, and here's the cure. So within all of that, one of the things which is characteristic of Buddhism is the Buddha really had a go at this sense of self, me, mine, because that was seen to be the real problem. If you've got me, then you've got mine, then you've got yours, and then I want yours. You know, it gets that kind of, that's where the problem starts. There's too much me suffering. So he really looked at what is this sense of self, and came up with this different approach by saying that there isn't this self thing in the first place. If you really see through that, then all of this stuff starts to dissolve. So there's been it starts off with an analysis, and that's where this thing about these five skandhas or five aggregates comes in. And so this is, instead of having a soul or a spirit or something separate, the Buddha breaks things down into much more a series of processes, and this is how you create this illusory sense of separateness, is through these modules, if you like. It's quite before its time in some ways. But people have just really looked into their own minds, and they broke things down. They broke things down into smaller and smaller units. So form is broken down into the six sense faculties, the six sense objects, and then, you know, imperceptible forms. So I'll put these out because I've made a kind of a mind map of them, because they get terribly complicated. When you get an analysis like this, I've likened it to Lego bricks. You know, if you've got Lego, it's got little bricks, and you can make little objects. And I've got a little Lego Skanda thing back at Telfer, which is made out of Minecraft bits. And it's a way of showing that these were made out of building blocks. You know, here's a building block, is, you know, a neutral sound would be a building block, or an unpleasant smell would be a building block. So that, and these all then interact together to create these kind of, you know, impressions that we have. So there's a great analysis called the Abhidharma, and it's still very much studied today. You can get, there's a Burmese temple in Birmingham that does an online Abhidharma course. So there, and it's head banging. It really is. It's very, very complex, explaining how all of these components interact to create things which we experience, in a sense. So this idea of breaking down the self idea into form, you've got internal, you know, form that you are, your mind, external forms that you perceive. These things are broken down into sub tiny building blocks. Another one of those is sensation, which is kind of like, so there's the object, then there's an ability to sense it. So you have sense organs, like there's something which you out there, like it's a chocolate biscuit, but it's not a chocolate biscuit yet. It's like that object, then the eye perceives it. So you've got some kind of, and then there's an eye consciousness which registers it, and then there's something else which labels it, and then there's something else which will have an intention towards it. So that's the kind of skanda process. It's a way of describing how you see a chocolate biscuit. The object, sense, you know, sensation of it. Then you start to have something that labels it, and then you start to have an intention or something else towards it. So these are these five skandas. So there's Form, sensation. And these have been translated as form, sensation, thought, activity and consciousness. But then you go somewhere else and you'll see they've got all these other names which can help you just get some sense of what's been talking about. Sensation can also mean feeling or sense impressions. Thought is... it means to know, in a sense. That's what the Sanskrit word means, to know, or perception, or you name it, or you recognise what that particular sense impression is. So that's thought can be quite misleading sometimes. English words are very specific, so you can try to use a word, and you have to use other words. I think German might be better sometimes. Yeah. Yes, you said German's much better than this. So I'm afraid I've got to do it in English instead. Some will have to do it in German. So then there's activity, which are kind of mental constructions. In the Sanskrit, it's sanskara. It means putting things together. You start to put it all together. So you've registered it. You've got labelled it. You're going to put it together in some form or another. And then you need that kind of consciousness to sort of register it. So in Buddhism, there are six senses. There's not just one, not just five. There's an extra one, which is the mind, which senses thoughts. So these are all just seen as inputs, if you like. And then this is what we do with them. So that kind of analysis, if you have that view, then you start to analyze something to the point that you can't see the self in it. You see what I mean? It's a bit like you go to IKEA and you get a table. you see the flat pack, you can't see the table. If you start to assemble it, then you can see it's all these components. Another quite nice analogy that's been used is like a rainbow. In order to see a rainbow, certain things have to be in place. So the sun has to be behind you. You have to have mist or clouds or rain or steam or some kind of water droplets in front of you. And the light has to go through to the water droplets, get refracted and split into the different frequencies, red, green, yellow colours. Then your eye perceives that. And so you perceive the rainbow. And if you're right on the top of a very high mountain, you can, and it's cloudy, apparently you can see, I've never seen this, but you can complete circle, because that's the sun, is circular, and you can see this circular rainbow. But the rainbow is something which is, you can see that it's there, but you can never find the the bottom of the rainbow, where the giant trove of gold is supposed to be, because it's not real in quite that way. It's something which we create because of all of these conditions. So this is the idea behind the Skanda thing, is that you're creating this sense of self, which is illusory and necessary. We couldn't really operate without one. But they don't hold on to it too tight, because it's created out of these components. So that's the analytical approach to seeing that, where is this self? Well, it's quite counterintuitive, because we jolly well have one. Or it seems that we do, but this kind of cuts away at that idea of it's not so fixed as you think. It's not really there in quite the way that we tend to expect. This kind of independent sort of fixed thing is seen as not really there. And there's another way of looking at it, is to more a relational way of looking at things, is to see that everything is interconnected with everything else. So if you see the river, I've looked at my notes, it must have been ages ago I did this, it talks about the River X, so that was in Exeter. So the local river here, I suppose, would be the Rhine. So what is the river, And you start to see, is it the water in it, or is it the banks, or is it the path that it took? And if you, with the rivers near us, the one that in Telford, it's the River Severn that goes down a gorge called the Ironbridge Gorge. It didn't used to go that way, it used to go another way completely at one time. used to go to much further north. So these things are not fixed. They're always flowing. The banks are always changing. It's a whole business about, you know, who owns the river, because the banks change. You know, it's a problem. So the river, if you like, is a way of seeing that that is not fixed, and yet it's obviously there, but it's not. You can't nail it down because it's flowing and moving and changing, and it's made of almost like discrete components. So this way of cutting things down to say that there is, you know, there's just there isn't this self thing involved. And it's the same with us. We're interdependent with everything else. We start to see, well, what are you? Your body is apparently broken down. You know, the bones are constantly being pulled down and rebuilt. So your the components of what you are is not fixed. It's very obvious that you're not like you were when you were seven or something. You've just changed and grown, and your actual physical components within you have been recycled into the universe. And you're breathing, you know, the food that you breathe. It's obvious in many ways that we're part of a flowing process, but we tend to regard ourselves as being fixed and separate. So all of this stuff was a way of having a go at your idea of holding on to things. Don't hold on to it. These just all of these things are that there's no self in them. So that's why it talks about in their self nature we're seen as. And it talks about there's no self nature to these things, and then it also pushes it a bit further to say that they don't hold on to even those building blocks. It sort of cuts away at the holding on to this wonderful analysis. You have to let go of the building blocks, and see that they're void, unstained, and pure, if you like. The word emptiness in our culture is, it's a sort of unfortunate in some way, because it means, it kind of sounds negative, which is why Ramastaji wanted to translate the scripture Great Wisdom in a slightly different way. She used the word pure. She didn't eliminate the word void entirely, but instead of the word void, she put in the word pure. And that was because people had got the wrong end of the stick with the emptiness thing. And it was, if you go too far in the emptiness direction, you end up with nihilism, nihilistic, you know, there's nothing. And if you're not careful, there's nothing, so you can do what you want. It's very dangerous. And she'd met people who'd got into that with this. Too much of this wisdom end of the spectrum is always a bit of a problem. So, which is why, particularly with the emptiness flavour that's been put on this, you now have it's Avalokiteshvara who explains it. So in all of these wisdom scriptures, there's always compassion expressing wisdom. Wisdom, or they're together. Compassion and wisdom are always linked. In the temple, where at Appama temple, it's actually the Mida statue. The people who were there liked that statue, so that was the one. And someone went and bought the a Manjusri and a Samantabhadra from a Chinese temple, because they sell these wonderful little miniature Manjusris and Samantabhadras. They looked at them funny when they bought just one. I think they must have been quite expensive. You have to buy the pair. You have to buy the pair. You have to buy the compassionate bodhisattva, which is represented by Samantabhadra, and the wisdom. They go together. You don't have one. You don't have just that one. The one on the elephant. You just have to have both. And so you always see compassion and wisdom are linked into together, because you need both. If you have too much on the compassion side without the wisdom, it becomes too it doesn't see clearly what's needed, so it can be just too kind. It can be helpful not to give someone something so that they can find it for themselves. You know, and that might be, if you were too kind, you might just try and make it all right. But it's quite tough to sort of see that person really needs to find that for themselves and make that mistake for themselves. So it's compassion and this wisdom, or prajna. Prajna is translated as wisdom. Once again, wisdom in Western cultures implies something which, like you're talking about Yoda, very wise over long periods of time. There's that idea of someone who's accumulated wisdom, as opposed to Buddhist version of wisdom is much more seeing clearly into the nature of things. It's a different kind of, we haven't really got a word for it because we have a different background. So this is, wisdom implies this deep seeing into how everything is not so fixed and solid as you might think. It's much more process flowing, don't get caught, let go, go beyond those ideas. So when one starts to view things with this mind, then the obstacles dissolve. There isn't something which you're fixed in such a way. It's, you can sort of see through it. It's not so, it's not such a deal in that respect. If you use this way of looking at things, it's, you're not so caught up in things being fixed the way they are, or this has happened. It's not like that. It's much more that you're seeing things much more as a series of flow of events, if you like, a flow of consciousness, moments, momentary consciousness, point, as opposed to something which you've made into this fixed thing. So it's much more pulling away at this idea and seeing much more of a flow of moments in that way. And because you can see with that mind, then you're not, I wouldn't say you're not, you have the potential for not being so frightened or worried by things. The obstacles dissolve. And finally, there's the mantra, which mantras have is something which you say which has meaning, and this one is being translated. We use the mantra in the Jukai ceremonies, people chant the mantra in Sanskrit, and it's got a sound and power of its own just by chanting it. But it's been translated, and our particular translation is, it's not gone beyond, almost like vanished a puff of smoke end of the spectrum. It's pointing to going beyond and having becoming Buddha in that way, becoming the Buddha mind. But it's a flow, it's a movement. It isn't something final about it. It's a pointing to that flowing movement beyond. And apparently, I think Rinmaster Jiu said that Kō Zenji, her teacher, really insisted that they translate it like that. That it's going on beyond, always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. So it's not static. Nothing in this is static or fixed. Basically that's why we recite it. It's almost like, it's very hard to believe it because you have to put this into practice. So we recite the scripture and it helps you cut away at things which you're holding on to. And because the basis of Buddhism is letting go in that way, letting go and going on beyond.